Support for today's show comes from Squarespace, and I don't know if you know how special that support is, because you probably know Squarespace helps people build websites and set up the right domain they want for that website, and I don't know if you know anybody who has used them. Oh wait, you know me, Alex Schmidt, Schmitty the Clam, Schmitty the Champ, your pal. I recently made a kind of passion project, little podcast mini-series of my own. It is called One Way to Make an Emoji, and if you go to bisonemojipodcast.com, again, that is bisonemojipodcasts.com, you will see my Squarespace website. I had a great time putting together this little website that helps share this little thing I made, and I want you to have a similar experience for your own business, writing, photos, whatever you might be up to. So here's how you get yourself set up. Head to squarespace.com/cracked for a free trial. And when you're ready to launch, use the offer code cracked to save 10% off your first purchase of a website or domain. Hey there, folks. Welcome to another episode of the Cracked Podcast, the podcast all about why being alive is more interesting than people think it is. My name is Alex Schmidt. I'm also known as Schmitty the Clam. I'm also known as Schmitty the Champ. And I am also reading about King Lear, but sure as heck not writing King Lear. I bring up King Lear because an interesting message about that play by Shakespeare, written in 1606, sprang up around the lockdowns around the coronavirus reaching North America for the most part in 2020. 1606 to 2020, what's all that about? Here is that idea that started spreading around. The tweet by musician Roseanne Cash goes, quote, "Just a reminder that when Shakespeare was quarantined because of the plague, he wrote King Lear," end quote. And you probably heard that idea. Oh, when the brilliant Shakespeare was quarantined, right? When he had a totally unprecedented opportunity to sit around at home all the time, he wrote one of the greatest tragedies of all time that is about an old crazy king. So we're linking that tweet because the idea became very popular. We're also linking a piece in The Guardian by Shakespeare scholar Andrew Dixon because, guess what? The world is complicated. Roseanne Cash is great, and that tweet is accurate in terms of the timeline, right? King Lear was first performed in December of 1606, and a plague gripped the city of London the previous summer and autumn of 1606. The city's theaters closed, many people died, including Shakespeare's landlady, so it got very close to him. He almost definitely did some kind of self-quarantine and isolation, and he almost definitely wrote some of the words of King Lear, if not all of them, during that time. However, the spirit of the tweet is odd, because if nothing else, we are not used to coronavirus lockdowns. But Shakespeare was incredibly used to plague lockdowns and to the plague killing lots and lots of people in 1500 and 1600s England. In 1603, just 3 years before that 1606 lockdown, the plague came to London and killed 10% of the city's population. It literally decimated London just 3 years before. Plague was a fact of Shakespeare's entire life. When he was a baby in Stratford-upon-Avon in 1564, a plague outbreak killed 25% of that city's population. And plague was a fact of Shakespeare's entire career. Between 1603 and 1613, a decade that lots of people think is the prime of Shakespeare's career, the theaters in London were closed for a total of 78 months during that decade. That's more than 60% of the time theaters were closed because of disease. So Shakespeare wrote kind of everything during a plague lockdown or shortly before or after one. And it's extremely doubtful that he saw the 1606 plague roll in and say, aha, an unprecedented writing opportunity. So I think that's amazing, and I think knowing that also reshapes my picture of Shakespeare's time, right? Because you think of it being a little dirty and a little gross, but otherwise people are out and about and being interesting and wearing pumpkin pants and being social and having a great time. I don't know why I'm fixated on the pants. The point is the social element. But one way that being alive is more interesting than people think it is that throughout history we've had all kinds of crises and lockdowns that maybe didn't quite make the history books. Like maybe they get mentioned or maybe they get footnoted, but they're not the main thing that gets talked about or thought about when we think of that time. And our topic on this show is little-known crises and lockdowns of U.S. history. One more time, that is little-known crises and lockdowns of U.S. history. And I'm joined by two incredible guests for exploring anything in U.S. history and culture and just everything. My guests today are Jody Avergan and Nicole Hemmer. They are the hosts of a new podcast called This Day in Esoteric Political History. And I find that's kind of a winky title because it is not esoteric. It is just specific and fascinating and really, really great. Jody Avergan is an incredible podcast producer and host. You've probably heard his work on 538 or ESPN or their 30 for 30 series specifically, or on WNYC or many other places. And Nicole Hemmer is an incredible historian. She's working with Columbia University on their Obama Presidency Oral History Project. She's also author of the book Messengers of the Right, Conservative Media, and the Transformation of American Politics. That book will come up a few times on this show as well, because it's very interesting to think about where conservative media has come from. It's almost all post-World War II, or kind of pre, we'll explain. But it's also one element of how we deal with understanding the things that are going on in the world, right? All of the media becomes part of the picture. So I'm so glad I get to talk to Jody and Nicole about this, because their podcast has provided some of the stories that we're going to talk about, and also their overall ability to analyze a specific thing from the past and see how it impacts today, and also have all kinds of nuance as they do it, is really special. And I don't know about you, but I really like to think about crises and lockdowns and other things like that of the past in a time like now. In a recent episode with Jason Pargin, we also talked about an amazing Rebecca Solnit book about natural disasters and the responses to them, which I also found very kind of comforting. I just like to know that when a massive crisis or event happens, as a society, we get through, even if 1942 and 1934 and 1893 and these other very hard years happen, we keep going. So let's get into stories all about that. Please sit back. Or go check on Woodrow Wilson, because he's fallen asleep in front of the Prime Minister of Britain. Pretty embarrassing. And either way, here's this episode of the Cracked Podcast with Jody Avergan and Nicole Hemmer. I'll be back after we wrap up. Talk to you then. As we all look at the time we're in, obviously certain historical things are relevant to it, as you guys have talked about on your show, and I had never heard of the dim outs on the East Coast that you bring up for, it's particularly 1942, but I'd imagine for a lot of World War II.
Yeah, this is a really fascinating story, because when people think about World War II, they think of the home front and the war front as being two very distinct places. And most people don't really know that German submarines were lurking off of the East Coast of the United States during a big chunk of the war, and that New York had to put measures in place, as did many cities and towns on the East Coast, in order to keep those submarines from effectively attacking merchant ships and American ships that were coming into New York and other places on the East Coast.
And then what you end up with is these images and this sort of picture of this city that has had to turn off all of its lights. At first, it was all the lights, I think, above 15 floors, just because of the way the angle of the light would reflect off the water. And then eventually, for in lots of places, especially right along the coast, which, for instance, includes Coney Island, which you think of as just so bright and so full of life, you know, just totally going dim and totally going dark. And at some level, reminder, I mean, we live in New York and have seen our city just shut down and quiet and come to a crawl, and a reminder that that has happened in New York before under a moment of crisis is why I find this story incredibly compelling.
Yeah, I think I had only heard of cities doing that kind of thing for like movie productions, right? Like, oh, for Vanilla Sky, they shut down Times Square for Tom Cruise, or like 28 Days Later, they found a weird hour of the day in London when they could do it. But this kind of thing has happened often, because I guess I hadn't thought of it until I heard your show, but they had to turn off lights so the ships wouldn't be visible, so the German submarines couldn't target them. Like, they had to redo the whole city.
Yeah, and they had to turn off, as Jody was saying, like the most New York parts of New York, which I think is the thing that makes it so striking. Like Times Square, all of the neon lights going down at a time when those neon lights were like the sign of commerce and vibrancy and New York as the Big Apple that people wanted to be. It really is symbolically really striking, as is like everyone agreeing to actually do it, because it wasn't
something, right?
Yeah, no, I mean, that's the thing, that people originally were asked to do it and they didn't, which is why the army came in and said, no, you really have to do it. And in fact, if you don't dim out your lights, we're going to put a blackout on the entire city. So yes, they're saving the people on the water, but they're also saving themselves from more onerous conditions going forward.
Are you telling me that a group of Americans was not down for collective action to protect everyone? Is that what you're saying?
It's shocking, yeah, no. I know.
Yeah. You know, the flip side of it being a reminder that, you know, we've gone through this before. There will always be a, I don't know, what's a generous way to put it, a conversation whenever, you know, these kinds of things come up. I mean, I saw someone sort of, I think, a little glibly say, like, well, what if, you know, during the Blitz in London, a bunch of people had said, well, no, I'm going to go out and live my life and I'm going to keep my lights on and so forth. And I don't, you know, I don't know about London in particular, but this story is a reminder that, yes, like, even when the stakes are really high, to disrupt people's lives, to make them think outside of themselves, and I'm not being cynical here, like, people should think about their own lives, is a lot. And, you know, how do you break through? How do you get people to act in a collective manner? You know, those are the big things that we should be drawing lessons about. And I think in general, along those lines, when I think of this story, one of the big lessons for me is when we think of sort of collective sacrifice during World War II, we think of, you know, people going off to war, obviously, and we think of manufacturing, and we don't think of these smaller moments that history has forgotten. It's a reminder that it is a succession of a lot of smaller moments, smaller sacrifices, smaller moments of collective action, often in smaller communities at the local level, that are really the heartbeat of, like, times like this. And so I think, for me, it's a reminder that, like, there's going to be a next time when we're going to have to think outside of ourselves. There's going to be one after that and one after that.
Yeah, and as a historian, I have to say one of the things that this moment, as we're calling it, has taught me is real historical empathy, right? Because if I had been thinking back to World War II, I would have just been imagining Americans sort of like gritting their teeth and going in and pitching in with the war effort. And here you kind of get a sense of the little sacrifices and also like why there would be resistance to it and why people wouldn't want to go along and how they lived their lives in this blend of terror and panic and boredom and change and all of those things that we're experiencing. I think we can empathize a lot more with people who are living through a very different, but in some ways very relatable time.
That's so dead on. It feels so good to be able to relate to them on that. I also feel like I am often told that other generations did a better job of everything,
right,
especially that generation. Like, they were only good at stuff and we're lazy and we're millennial and we're not good at it. But no, like, there were whole America First committees saying we shouldn't even be in the war. And then there were people saying, like, no, we shouldn't turn off the, I think you guys picked out the Planters peanut sign in Times Square. Like, no, we shouldn't turn that off just because the Germans are here. Yeah. What? Like, how will we sell peanuts then? But, crazy.
So this is one of my questions then. So what does it say that we remember the people who did act? We do have this image of people acting collectively and in sacrificing themselves and for the greater good. And we don't remember those little moments as much. Does it mean, you know, to extrapolate to today, does it mean that we are not going to remember the 15-person anti-vaxxer protest that took place outside of that? And we are going to remember the millions of people who stayed home and kind of went out of their way to think about the collective?
It's a really good question.
Oh, wow. Well, I really am heartened by that idea because I think everybody who's staying home is getting less coverage than the small gathering of people in a state capital. And I would like to think that history would do what the media is not doing.
So the reason why I want to quash any sort of optimism about this is because
Please.
One of the reasons why we remember that sort of collective sacrifice is because remembering it as successful collective sacrifice was part of building a national mythology and a national identity.
Right.
And you had media and institutions and politicians from both parties and across the ideological spectrum who were devoted to that mission of myth making. And I'm not sure that we have that same, for good and bad, that we have that same sort of national identity and national myth making set of institutions.
Nicole, you've done such amazing research and coverage and everything else of the rise of conservative media. I'm wondering if, like, institutions like that coming about kind of fracture, that kind of thing? Because it seems like a lot of the conservative media was post-World
War II. Yeah, and in fact, the conservative media activists that I write about in my first book, they are politicized, or they are activated by their experience in something that you mentioned, which is the America First Committee, that they had opposed the U.S. going into war. And then they looked around and they saw all of the political parties and the universities and the newspapers, and those sources of power were all saying, no, we have to go to war. And so they looked at that and they said, ah, like all of the institutions of society are arrayed against us. We have to find a way of getting our viewpoint and our politics out there. And so they build media and a movement and a politics that become what we know today as Fox News and the Republican Party and the conservative movement. And it has powerfully reframed American politics and media and all of those things in a way that just makes it a fundamentally different world than people were living in the 50s and 60s.
It seems also like that's a really important change for just everything. Like it's not necessarily that more voices are being heard. I guess a few are, but also it's the kind of thing where it's like, these people said, I went to all those German-American Bund meetings, and now nobody talks about the things we did. That's a really weird source of that fracturing coming about.
It is. You know, they would often argue that as American Firsters, they weren't German Bunders. They were part of a cross-ideological coalition that included socialists and Democrats and Republicans and liberals and all of these people who had questions about World War II and felt attacked by the idea that they were just a collection of Nazis. Now, they didn't necessarily all disprove those criticisms in the years that followed, but it was part of their sense, like they found a kernel of something to criticize and were able to build that into something much, much, much bigger.
With seeing these groups properly, like we talked about some of these people protesting the current lockdown as anti-vaxxers and stuff, and many of them are. And then it seems like there's also a point that some people are raising, and it's debatable, but they're like, if we lose the economy in the process of locking this down, isn't that worse? And I disagree. But I wonder with this like dim out back in the 40s, like maybe there's no way to know, but I wonder if people were saying something similar. Like, oh, if we turn off all the cities and if Coney Island can no longer employ anybody, is that worse than the Germans sinking some ships?
Right. Somewhere in here is the difference between a war against another nation and a war, if you want to call it that, or, you know, a fight against an illness that doesn't really act rationally and doesn't care and so forth. And so, I mean, I think, you know, that's one of the frustrating things here is that we have some people behaving as if we're in a traditional war, other people not understanding what it means to fight against the virus. And also just kind of like, I like just don't really get where the battle lines are drawn. Like I don't, there is not logic to who is on what side as much as in some other political fights.
Right. And if you look at the polls, like this isn't partisan fight over how we should be responding to this pandemic. I mean, most Americans, the vast majority, think that we're pushing to get everyone back out in public a little too soon. These protests that you're talking about, you know, there are certainly people who are genuinely hopeful and willing to be activists and go out there and say, oh, I just need to get back to my job. But that's not actually who those people are on the front lines, by and large. I mean, these are carefully built, Jody mentioned anti-vaxxers, but militias and conservative groups who are using this moment in order to win some political power and political cachet, but that it doesn't reflect what's actually going on in the broader American public.
Nikki, when these protests first popped up, you and I were just chatting and we both said, oh man, this feels a lot like the Tea Party. That was a few weeks ago. Does that analogy still hold for you?
Yeah, I think so, because they're getting bigger. They're getting more politicized. If you tune into conservative media, you're actually seeing something that happened with the Tea Party, which is that the Tea Party protests actually started off as very small local things and then became politically useful and got much bigger, and their targets began to change and they began to get used towards different political ends, particularly anything that the Obama administration stood for. And it's hard to say right now because we don't know where this ends. But you're seeing a lot of the same forces at play that you saw back then. It's just that people are actually a lot more afraid of this virus than they were of, like, the Affordable Care Act.
That has been heartening, too, when, like, I see at some of these protests, like, there was one in Raleigh, the capital of North Carolina, where people were protesting, but they were also staying inside their cars and keeping distant from each other. Like, it's heartening to see them, like, still do some scientific stuff even as they do this.
I think there are very few people who actually think that this virus is something that cannot hurt them. I think that's just a very, very small group of people, and you see that reflected in people's unwillingness to actually do the things that they're calling for.
Yeah. Maybe let's look at another story that you guys pick out a fascinating element of, because I think people have heard of the worldwide flu pandemic 1918 and 19, but you guys have an amazing episode about, it's not totally confirmed, but the potential situation where Woodrow Wilson catches this flu, which I think is not well known, that the president was one of the people who caught it.
I think I had always thought of it as the 1918 pandemic and knew that there was a first wave in the spring and a second wave in the fall. And then in researching this, realizing that, oh, wow, Wilson caught it, you know, 1919 tells you something about how long these things last and about, you know, just kind of gives us some perspective. But then, yes, I mean, he was on his way to Paris for negotiations to wind down World War One, and he became incredibly ill. And there's reports at the time, some reports that he had a stroke. People knew he was ill, right, Nikki? It wasn't like they were covering that up, but it was just like, what is the nature of this illness?
Yeah, they knew that he was like, he seemed tired. He didn't seem to be able to connect his thoughts. He seemed kind of out of it. And because later he would have a massive stroke, it got read back into the record that, oh, maybe he had a bunch of mini strokes during this visit.
You know, people were describing his behavior very much as the flu. And then, you know, I get the impression, I'm not a historian, but I get the impression that this is one of those, like, maybe a favorite of historians kind of sliding doors moments, because there is this theory that his being incapacitated and not on his A game at these negotiations ended up really changing the way World War One ended and potentially setting up the way World War Two started, because he basically conceded much more punitive action towards Germany. He was maybe wanted going into this, and his sort of nature and disposition was to go towards a little more appeasement, a little bit more of a negotiation, and instead the sort of like more punitive forces were able to have one over on him because he wasn't on his game.
He wasn't necessarily like pro appeasement of Germany, but just felt like, look, a lot of things happened to cause this war. We are more interested in peace than we are punishment. And so what we need to focus on here is how can everyone feel comfortable with the peace that we sign so that we can build this new organization, the League of Nations, that he believed could ensure world peace. And it was something he believed in so much. And it's one of the reasons he wanted the U.S. to get involved in the war in the first place, so it would have a seat at the table. And now he's at the table and he has a fever and he can't concentrate. And he's just been delivered a major political rebuke back home. And the combination of all of those things certainly helped lead to the more punitive piece that gets signed.
It's interesting because we have talked about that main stroke he had a bit on the podcast before, but as you mentioned, he was running a fever at this conference, and so it's probably, I think you guys outlined that it's probably not a mini stroke, because a fever is not a symptom of a stroke. It's just unrelated, but it's a pretty prime flu symptom.
Yeah, I think looking back at it, it looks a lot like the flu.
Would people at the time have been terrified, like, to learn just that the president had it at all? It seems like maybe they wouldn't have wanted to tell people.
Well, they didn't tell people, which is a good sign. His doctor came out and said, oh, well, he has a bad cold. And again, like, the symptoms don't really match up to a bad cold. They sound a lot like the pandemic flu that was going around. And so they work to sort of cover it up, because they don't want people to know how bad it is. And in fact, I mean, as you're saying, like, he has this stroke later that year, and they spend a lot of time covering that up too. He's functionally incapacitated for the last year of his presidency, and most people in America at the time don't actually know that. And that's, I mean, it's a scandal thinking about it today. It's the basis of the movie Dave, but it's a wild thing to have a president incapacitated and to have that covered up by his administration.
But I don't know, thinking about it now, right? What would actually change if the president or the vice president, I mean, it's, as we're taping this, it seems to be moving into the inner circle in the White House. So we're going to maybe have this moment to evaluate what difference it makes. I mean, to me, I don't think it will change anything about my understanding of how serious this is or how contagious this is. You know, my one thought is that it may make the president understand it slightly differently, just because I have a sense of how he operates. But that's different from kind of like, if the president gets it, it changes everyone's opinion of the seriousness of the nature or whatever.
Yeah, I mean, I think that there's something to the idea that at the time, particularly in the first half to two-thirds of the 20th century, the president was sort of symbolic of the body politic. And so you have somebody like Theodore Roosevelt, who emphasizes his manliness and his strength, and it sort of stands in for the manliness and the strength of America. And there were a lot of concerns in the 1930s about FDR and that he needed to show that he could actually stand on his own two feet in order to assure the country that he was healthy enough and that America was going to be strong. And so I do think that there's something to that, but I think you're also right that, like, would people have lost their minds if they found out he had the flu? Well, if he recovered from it, not really.
But do you think that's how the Trump administration sees themselves? Like, we are the symbol of American power and the political body, and so if we show weakness, it shows weakness about our politics in general?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's one of the dangers of the l'état, c'est moi way of thinking about government is that this idea that you can't show physical weakness because it is an expression of political weakness. And I think we've seen that with Donald Trump throughout his very short political career.
If I remember right, in the 2016 debates or other interviews or something, he claimed that his opponent, Hillary Clinton, lacked stamina to do the job. So, like, I think he's pushing that idea, right, to the whole country.
Sure.
Yeah, and they used this conspiracy theory about Hillary Clinton being deathly ill throughout the 2016 campaign and the cover-up of her illness as, like, a wedge or as a part of the fake news industry during that time. And that, I think, again, is, like, this idea that your opponent is weak if they're sick is definitely part of the working assumption.
Do you think Donald Trump will ever wear a mask in public?
I just can't imagine that he ever does. I mean, he hasn't.
I've seen memes of him being like a Mortan Joe from the Mad Max Fury Road movie. So that's the closest I've come to seeing it.
Like a Bane-style mask.
That's about it. Yeah. Bane, sure, yeah. I could see him wearing one to sell them if he starts manufacturing
well,
them.
Well, he has started manufacturing them. His campaign has them already.
They're branded masks.
They are branded masks, and they sent some pictures out from someone wearing one in the White House in order to start the process of selling them. They might be handing them out at rallies and things like that as well.
Okay, there you go.
Every satirical attempt, he's just like, nope, already did it.
Satire is dead.
There's another story we've got here, and this in many ways centers on the first president. And this is that, you know, people think, oh, it's incredibly rare to have a disease pandemic. It's only now and the flu in 1918. But there's an amazing book that I've used for a cracked video about American history and stuff. But it's called Pax Americana, the Great Smallpox Epidemic of 1775 to 1782. It's by Elizabeth A. Fenn, who's a history professor at University of Colorado at Boulder. And she digs into how basically, the entire American Revolution was also happening during a massive smallpox epidemic throughout the North American continent. And so we have this mental picture of, you know, just guys in a sunny field shooting muskets at each other. But also there was just this constant disease pandemic and lockdown going on for everybody involved. Smallpox is a disease that the World Health Organization did a lot to eradicate in the 20th century, but back in the 1700s, it would kill approximately 3 out of 10 people who caught it, and it shows no symptoms during its 2-week incubation period. And so in this book, Fenn lays out how basically as troop movements started happening and organization for the revolution started happening, smallpox just massively spread throughout the 13 colonies. And we think of that war as just a halcyon time of fighting for freedom, even though there was also a pandemic happening all the time.
Yeah, a strong connection with 1918 as well, because it's happening that combination of war and disease is something we find quite often because people are moving around a lot more and they have access to a lot less sanitary conditions. And the combination of those two things help disease to spread. And that's one of the things that's happening during the American Revolution is that this disease is being spread through the troops and by the troops across the country and coming at a pretty high price.
We marvel at, oh my gosh, there was a pandemic during this war and there was a pandemic during World War I. And you know, now there's a pandemic during a time when it feels like things are incredibly fractured and so forth. Is it just cognitive bias that we're, you know, when two big things happen, we're going to point those out? And when there was just a pandemic and no other big thing, we're not remembering that? Or are you saying that, like, they are actually linked in some sort of more, in some actual way?
I think both of those things are true. Like, they are linked by the movement of peoples, like that does spread disease and it causes these pandemics to be worse. But because both war and pandemic are destabilizing, the combination of the two destabilizing events make it just like this bigger historical moment. I think we talk about other pandemics here and there. We talk about the spread of disease like polio. But when it combines with something like this, it makes it just for a richer discussion, because we tend to separate the two in our minds. Like, how often do we talk about smallpox and the American Revolution? They're just not two things we often combine. And so I think it's surprising to us when we put those two things back together. And that's why people get more interested in it.
I also wonder if maybe we're more ready to talk about a pandemic when it's during a war, because then the pandemic is almost something we are weathering for a noble cause, or the, at least the people involved are like getting through in order to accomplish something. Like, I feel like a lot of people are struggling, or and a few of them are even going out and protesting in state capitals because they're like, this pandemic has no point. Like, I need to be accomplishing something for freedom on top of the pandemic. Then it's okay. Then it's fine.
And it also opens the door for like lots of counterfactuals. Like, everybody wants to know, like, what was the thrown horseshoe that caused Napoleon to lose the war? And so if you can come up with something interesting, if you can be like, oh, well, actually it was Woodrow Wilson having the flu, or actually it was smallpox that turned things around for the siege of Boston. Like, that's, I think people get interested in that more because it seems so unusual, even though, as we're saying, like, it's not that unusual, but it's more interesting in that way.
So Washington, during the siege of Boston, he seemed to be very unaware and understood the sort of seriousness of this pandemic and was taking sort of I think creative measures to account for it. One of them was he asked that all of his letters be dipped in vinegar before he opened and read them, which I don't know if that kills smallpox or not, but I just had this notion in my head that like some critical word would get blurred out because he dipped it in vinegar, and all of a sudden it was like, you know, forces are going to do a surprise attack on, and then like it's blurred out and he doesn't see it, and then it turns the course of the war. That was the counterfactual I was hoping for, but I don't know if there's evidence of that.
I do love that imagery of him dumping all of his letters into vinegar, which too is something that I had not thought of. But if you, you know, if you don't have time to quarantine the letter for 40 days before you read it, you have to have something. And I'm glad that it wasn't just like a page who had to pick it up and read it to him.
And look, we're walking around like rubbing Lysol on our faces right now. Like, I don't think we can cast aspersions on someone dipping their letters in vinegar and taking every precaution they could.
Yes. I mean, the number of neighbors I have who are just like leaving their boxes outside so as not to bring the infectants into their home, I think is pretty similar. The thing that I was surprised by that I did not know about was this inoculation process. I mean, at a time when bleeding someone was a common way of treating a disease, that they had figured out that if you inoculate someone, if you give them a little bit of the disease, have them weather that, and then they get immunity to it, they had that cracked. They were going around inoculating the troops in order to make them immune so that they could go out and fight. I thought that was unexpected and fascinating.
Yeah, a little background for people, because the smallpox was a terrible disease, and it was a thing where this particular epidemic from 1775 to 1782, it killed 130,000 people in the colonies, and they only had a population of 2.4 million, so that was over 5% of the entire population died of it. But also, this is a disease where, like you said, it is something that they had kind of figured out how to work on. A few decades later, Edward Jenner would discover ways to inoculate people by infecting them with cowpox, which is a less dangerous virus. And so then almost everyone survived that process. But before that, they figured out, hey, if we put some gross stuff from a smallpox sore into a cut on your arm, then you get the disease and are less likely to die than normal. And once you catch smallpox and survive, you're immune forever. And so throughout the war, Washington and the British are both doing a process where they say, okay, should I inoculate my troops? Because then they'll be sick for 3 or 4 weeks before they're better and immune. Do I have 3 or 4 weeks to burn? Or do I just march them in a troop of guys who I don't think have it and hope they don't catch it? And there was just this constant disease balancing going on throughout the entire Revolutionary War. Like, that doesn't come up in the movies or the books or anything.
I mean, it sort of makes you realize that the way that we fight these things is basically the same. I mean, the strategy back then was, you know, isolate people and then try and give them a little bit of it to protect them. You know, basically those are the only tools we have now, too.
Yeah. And the other thing that I think that it's a reminder of is that these wars I don't know. I think that we often think of them as like fighting every day for like 4 or 5 years. But one of the reasons they were able to inoculate the soldiers was because there were these big lulls in fighting, right? Like you can't fight that much in the winter. So when they're wintering in Valley Forge, people are dying for a lot of reasons, including the weather. But like you have a break in the fighting right, where you can give everyone smallpox and make it through to the other side.
Yeah, according to Fenn's book, that winter in particular was very helpful to Washington's force, and by mid-1778, he felt like most or all of his troops had been inoculated against smallpox or killed. But the ones who were still around had that, and then that was very useful operationally. Washington caught smallpox as a kid in the 1750s and just happened to survive, and so throughout the war, he didn't have any personal worry about it.
I love that. It definitely feeds into the Washington mythology of, like, hand chosen to both lead the fight in the revolution and to lead the country, because he was immune by the time the war comes around. And so there's no concern about losing him from disease. If he's going to go down, he's going to go down fighting.
So where do you guys come down on this? Do you think you can make a case that smallpox swung the war?
I mean, wars are multi-causal.
Yeah. Hey, that's nuanced. Hold on.
What I mean is smallpox is the reason why we have America today.
There you go.
In Fenn's book, there's two really interesting stories. One is that siege of Boston that we brought up before. That was in late 1775, and it seems like the disease didn't totally change the outcome, but it was a thing where both sides were trying to manage smallpox to the point where when the British left because the Americans set up artillery properly, Washington didn't want to go into the city because he was afraid that would be a disease trigger. And he ended up sending a column of 1,000 troops who he knew every one of them were immune to smallpox. They could go first and like arrange things, which is just the weirdest story to have going on. And then one other thing she brings up in the book is that really early in the war, May 1775, Benedict Arnold, who was a good guy at that point, had taken Fort Ticonderoga and then tried to invade Quebec and like take over Canada. And she argues that they took Montreal successfully, but then they had to end a siege of Quebec City because smallpox ripped through the American army and they didn't have enough guys to win it anymore. So she suggests that maybe Canada would be part of the U.S. if smallpox hadn't intervened.
So not only is smallpox the reason we have the United States, but it's the reason we have Canada, too.
It's a strong pro-smallpox stance from Nicole Hemmer here. Bold.
Well, and like the side of this that we haven't talked about is in terms of smallpox and the formation of the nation is that it actually killed so many indigenous people and is one of the reasons that made it possible for Europeans to colonize both the what would become the United States and Canada.
That story, the disease blankets, that was smallpox, right? I mean, smallpox was one of the first sort of
biological weapon,
yeah, disease warfare, yeah.
Because also Fenn talks about smallpox. It comes from Europe to America, and so Native Americans were extremely vulnerable to it. And then also she describes that even during the Revolution, the white colonists were, like, less used to smallpox than the Europeans were. And so there were fears that the British would be, like, better against it, and that would be an advantage for them. But every history I read of the Revolution is just who had more ships and guns and money, you know? Like, you never talk about
it doesn't
that.
Come up in Hamilton, so did it actually happen? It's not canon.
We need smallpox music. Then people
know.
It's
just a tough rhyme, you know? Actually, no, it's a pretty easy rhyme.
Also, I think Lin-Manuel Miranda is up for it.
Many thanks to Squarespace for their support of this show, The Cracked Podcast. And I am thankful to them for their support of BisonEmojiPodcast.com, a Squarespace website and domain that I recently set up because I made a miniseries. Again, it is called One Way to Make an Emoji, 4 short episodes about a very special story in my life and the story of creating the Bison Emoji, like a real emoji that will be on your phone and every device later this year, 2020. I wanted that to have its own little home on the internet, and so using Squarespace was a very simple and very intuitive and very just fun way to build a spot for it. They have beautiful templates created by world-class designers. I took one of those and then I customized it exactly the way I wanted it to be. If you go and look at BisonEmojiPodcast.com, you will see that it has a home for podcast embeds, it has a home for all kinds of links and photos, and it supports GIFs, and it supports emojis in text, which was obviously very important to me. And then beyond all that, they have e-commerce functionality. If you are someone who is selling something, they have built-in analytics so you can track who's coming. And they make buying domains very easy and very simple. I acquired buyasanemojipodcast.com with no sweat, no stress. It was just great. I also have a website that is optimized for mobile right out of the box, so I recommend checking it out on your phone. It will look good there too. And I want you to have the kind of experience I had. So head to squarespace.com/cracked for a free trial. And when you're ready to launch, use the offer code cracked to save 10% off your first purchase of a website or domain. That is squarespace.com/cracked, offer code cracked. Well, we've got a few other stories here, and one that you guys pick out in particular on your show is a massive economic panic. Because one thing that people, especially a few weeks ago when the Dow was very, very low, a lot of people were saying like, well, we're going to lose the whole economy to this, and that's the real crisis. And I think people know about the Great Depression, and they might be aware that there was a recession in their lifetimes. But other than that, they don't know about the many, many, many other economic panics in history, in particular the Panic of 1893. Nobody thinks about 1893 as a year. It's just back there. But it was one of the most astonishing economic crises ever.
Yeah, I actually think it gives you a sense of how catastrophic the Great Depression was, that it was able to historically just wipe out the memory of these really catastrophic panics of the late 19th century. These were things that were happening like every 20 years. You were having these massive economic collapses that were not only upending the economy, but like, you're talking about a time when most Americans live in poverty. And so to lose your job, to have the economy go south, is something that put most Americans at risk in a very existential kind of way. And so that we don't have a strong historical memory of this, I think, is a testament to how bad the Depression of the 1930s was.
I think the political dynamic dimension of 1893 is really interesting as well, and the way it intersects with the economic collapse. I mean, the fact that we have the sort of Gilded Age pivoting into the start of the Progressive Era. And then we talked about this on the show, but, you know, it's really like these moments where it's not just an economic collapse or political turmoil, but it is this real sense that the country is turning from one kind of country to another. And in this case, 1893, you know, an agrarian economy to an industrialized economy. And I would argue that's really kind of in the background of this moment now, too, just this sort of uneasiness about what are we as a country? What is the thing that we do? And when you have those questions lingering, it just like causes all these sort of bigger dimensions and causes these bigger fissures when you do have an economic slowdown or a pandemic or, you know, sort of heightened political moment.
And for the first time in a real way, during the 1893 crisis, you get people asking, what should the government be doing to protect people from these kinds of crises? Because before, it was sort of like, everyone's on their own. But now, because people can't individually save themselves from these cataclysms within the economy, there's a real movement to say, here are the steps that the federal government has to take in order to protect farmers, in order to protect workers. And it takes a while, right, for this to finally like burst through on the political scene. But even like 1896, you have William Jennings Bryan running as the candidate for the Populist Party. You have it breaking through at the national level, this call for the federal government to intervene and save people. And at the time, is the federal government big enough to really do that? It's starting to get there. But, you know, without an income tax, without the kind of money that would be flowing into the federal government in the 20th century, you still have, you know, robber barons who are bailing out the federal government instead of the other way around. So it's a tricky moment of trying to figure out what the government can do and what the government should do.
It's amazing to think of the government as not having very much money. Because you mentioned there was no income tax, and then they were just in a situation where they were kind of hoping that rich people would step in.
Well, so that's actually what happens, yeah. So you don't have an income tax on the federal level until 1913.
That's amazing that there was this turn that people in 1893 said, oh, now we should start to have like systems. Because you describe on the show that throughout the 1870s and other years, too, there were other crises. And I guess people just had like the whatever physical money they had in their pocket and home. Like that's basically all they had going for them.
Yeah, I mean, it's an era in which you see like the rise of unions and the rise of farmers' collectives. Like people were doing a lot of things in the 1870s and 1880s to try to figure out what kind of collective action would rescue them. But the problems are so severe that it becomes increasingly clear that it takes both local collective action, but it also takes some bigger, richer entity to make things safer and more fair.
So how are you guys seeing this play out now with this pandemic? Because I have to say, I was like a little surprised. It may be changing in the last week or two, but when it first landed, I was honestly a little surprised at how much there was just seemed to be consensus that government has a huge role to play here. Like, you didn't hear the, like, people should just handle this on their own, or you know, we're going to do this through private enterprise. You didn't hear the, like, libertarian counter talking point trotted out. And I was kind of surprised. It was just like everyone said, yes, government is going to fix this, and then we'll have arguments at the dimensions by which they will fix it. It felt like this interesting moment, like you were saying, Nikki, where the country is faced with a crisis and then has to really just sort of say, oh, yes, this is why we have government. And everyone kind of agrees at some level.
I hadn't thought of it that way, but that's dead on. Yeah, because so often with these things, you hear like, well, the Great Recession happened, but surely businesses can figure it out for us and, you know, it'll all be fine. But this one, people were like, no, the government should get involved. Like maybe this is a real pandemic or not, was a thing people were saying in February. But once it was real, people were like, no, there should be a response.
Yeah, once it was real, meaning when the stock market started to tank.
Right.
I do think that it is a testament to how stunned people were and how rapidly things changed, that you got this sort of immediate consensus that we need to spend trillions of dollars and you need to get money into people's hands right now in order to make sure that the country stays afloat. Because that kind of political consensus, it wasn't there in 2008 when the economy collapsed. Here's my thinking on this. If you had had a Democratic president at the start of this pandemic, I'm not 100% sure that you would have seen this consensus. You certainly wouldn't have seen it last as long as it did. I think it's pretty much over at this point. But for those first three rounds of coronavirus funding, that had a lot to do with the fact that you had a Republican in power. And so Republicans were willing to get on board.
And that's not to paper over the fact that it was when the stock market collapsed and a bunch of, you know, rich people saw their bottom lines being affected. That's when sort of, you know, government kicked in, and that a lot of the welfare was for corporations. Like, you know, there was a moment there where I legitimately was like, wait a minute, is Donald Trump going to implement universal basic income? Like, that felt like actually might happen. Like, oh my gosh, you know?
Yeah. I mean, anything felt possible. And you'll notice that it kind of stopped once the stock market rebounded, which is another part of the story of, like, the panic of 1893 and these other panics, is that the thing that becomes the headline is where the stock market is at. And as we're seeing right now, like, the stock market, not a great barometer of the economic health of the country. Because I don't think anybody would look around right now and say, yeah, economy is doing great. People are confident. Consumer confidence is up. Like, we should have a rallying stock market. And yet, that's what we had. Like, it's rebounded some 4,000 to 5,000 points. And on the basis of what? Yeah. The companies are going to be fine.
That is one of the most 1893 things about this to me, that, like, you guys pick out on the show that I think it was 11 out of 12 million Americans were in poverty as the Gilded Age happened, and as that top 1 million got just enormous wealth sent their way, more or less. Like, with this thing, I really feel like there's kind of two classes, and I'm in the very lucky class on top that doesn't have to go to a physical workspace. Yeah. Like, it seems like it's going very differently for people across the board.
Well, that's one of the things I feel like I'm learning just over the course of doing this show, is that, you know, more than anything, big crises and these big political moments sort of reveal the underlying structures more than anything. And that's what this one is doing. It is kind of showing us what our country really is, more than it is even like changing our country.
And I think that that's so important, not just on the class inequality side, but on racism, right? Like, the one thing that has actually remained really constant throughout this pandemic is that the structural racism of the economy, of policing, all of that has remained the same, even as this, you know, crisis was supposed to bring everyone together and make everyone equal. Really, it's exposed just how unequal all of the systems are.
Yeah, wow. Also, we were talking about the Great Recession, and I feel like even as that happened to so many people and hit the whole economy, there was still a narrative out there of like, well, this is really bad for people who had a second mortgage, and everybody else who was wise, you know, they're okay, which is not true. But I heard that kind of thing. And with this panic of 1893, you have massive unemployment, massive business failure. It was up to 25% unemployment in Pennsylvania, 35% in New York, 43% in Michigan. And then you guys describe how they had policemen stationed at railroad stations to prevent people from, like, trying to flee to a new city where things would be better. Like, it seems like that economic panic, like the economic trouble now, is just everywhere for everybody. And maybe that doesn't fix any of our systemic problems, but it does mean everybody's involved in it.
Well, it certainly has concentrated the mind. And I think that's why those early political actions that Jody was pointing to, this idea that, wow, everyone's responding, especially in those early days, was because there was this sense that everyone is equally affected. And so there's nobody who's safe. And I think that as that has become clear that that's less true, there's been a move away from that. We're all in it together. But that definitely was the sense in the early days of this pandemic, that just, like, anyone can get sick, anyone can die, and we all need to work together in order to make sure that we don't have as catastrophic of effects as we could have.
With 1893, as I understand it, it lasted also way beyond that year. Like, it took until around 1897 to start to alleviate. I think we touched on a few. What are some other positive things and structures and ways of running society that came out of that crisis? Because it seems like people did, either accidentally or on purpose, learn some lessons from it.
Well, so a lot of the changes that you see coming out in the early 20th century, so more regulation. So you have more food regulation and drug regulation and more workplace safety regulation. All of those things are coming out of the unrest that builds after the Panic of 1893, as does this push for more democracy. I mean, one of the things that we've talked about on the show is the direct election of senators, which happens with the 17th Amendment. And that comes out of this moment. It's something that the populists were agitating for because they believed that you couldn't have economic equality until you had a truly democratic government. And so being able to directly elect senators was a way of getting the people's voice in politics more and working around some of these elite institutions.
It's just this part of this larger sweep and this larger question of how connected do people feel to their government? How much do people feel like government affects their day-to-day lives? And crises just sort of bring that into sharp relief. But in many ways, like, you can track the ebbs and flows of American history through that sort of metric. People are just starting to confront that question of, like, oh, you know, government can protect me or government can harm me. I wouldn't be surprised if we walk some of the same paths that we walked in the late 1800s.
Yeah, you're seeing a switch to a new economy as well, which is something that was happening in 1893. And one of the interesting parts of some of the early coronavirus relief has been, how do we protect gig workers? We haven't really set up a social safety net for gig workers. And it's at least putting those questions on the table in a really, really important way.
If some kind of new progressive movement comes out of all this, it had roots that have nothing to do with this. Like, California had started to do AB 5 as a law to try to protect gig workers somehow, some way. And we were seeing politicians like AOC come through just because that's a good idea. And then also this happened, you know, later. Maybe it's all kind of converging.
Well, yeah. And then you'd heard, you know, for years, I think people kind of say, like, we're a service economy. We haven't realized that yet. We haven't grappled with that yet, but we have to realize that we're changed. And then so moments like this just kind of, like, force us to realize that and force us to confront it. And who knows, it may have been another 10 years until we finally realized that and had those conversations. And now I suppose we just have to.
There's two more stories here I want to kind of touch on before we go, because if they're instructive to this moment, maybe it's because they're just natural phenomena that just happened and people just sort of weathered them. One is the 1816 Year Without a Summer, which happened really across the Northern Hemisphere, but especially in New England and the U.S. And it was because Mount Tambora in Indonesia erupted the previous year, 1815. That eruption killed 92,000 people and blotted out the sun for a few days in its area. But then no one realized that that was going to create an ash cloud that basically wiped out the entire summer of 1816, causing massive crop failure, causing just a lot of psychological trouble from all the cold and all the strange weather. And New England reported things like 18 inches of snow in June in Vermont. Also, it was 30 degrees in Amherst, New Hampshire in August. And in general, just the entire Northern Hemisphere went through a year when they were kind of locked down by the earth. Like, there was nothing you could do about it suddenly being winter for an entire summer.
Yeah, and you see the knock-on effects of that, like you were saying. Like, every single month of the year of 1816 in North America had a hard frost, which meant that those crops were all spoiled. And what do you do when all the crops are ruined? Like, people starve to death, all because a volcano half a world away erupted.
Yeah, and I think no one saw what they could do about it. Like, we've got stories here from the New England Historical Society of farmers, like, wrapping rags around their plants to try to keep them warm, like blankets. But, like, you can't go to the government and say, like, the earth blew up, so you need to print more crops. Like, there's no solution to that, really. It's just something you're
rolling
with.
Wrapping the crops, but also wrapping the sheep, because there's also the story of farmers who had sheared their sheep and then tried to tie the wool back on to keep them warm during these cold snaps. Didn't work, by the way. The sheep still died, but I admire the effort. Oh. I know.
Now, do you want to talk about the Frankenstein element of this, too? I think that was fascinating that, you know, bad weather forces people to stay inside. And then when they're stuck inside, they sometimes come up with interesting things. And so is this right? Mary Shelley wrote Frankenstein because she was just kind of cooped up indoors?
Yeah, she talks about, like, having gone, I think it was to Switzerland for the summer, and they had these plans to have all of these lovely outdoor days. And instead, they're trapped inside because it's unseasonably cold. And so she's actually able to write this novel that would become one of the staples of the English canon, which I have to say, I kind of take it as a personal attack on days when I'm like, I showered today. I'm right. Winning lockdown. And some people are out there, you know, writing Frankenstein. It does speak to the fact that people right now probably are creating some amazing pieces of art and being amazingly productive because their patterns of life have changed.
And and then the other story that is just an interesting creative work is the bicycle that comes out of this weird time when people were eating, among other things, their horses.
Mm-hmm. Right, that you didn't have the same kind of transportation available because your horses were being eaten. Yeah, so you get the bicycle, which later in the century would be a big tool of women's liberation, because this is one of the reasons why bloomers are invented, so women can ride bicycles, and the radical act of wearing pants is a big part of the women's liberation movement, and that leads to women eventually getting the right to vote. So the summerless summer of 1816 leads directly to women's liberation.
So this is known, I don't know, maybe it's not widely known, but I mean, you know, I think it's referred to as the year without summer. I've been thinking about kind of what they're going to call this little period, you know? I mean, in my head, I've been calling it like the lost summer or the cooped up summer or something. I'll be curious to see kind of how we just think of this moment a year from now, whether we come up with a phrase for it like that.
When you have an event that so radically restructures people's lives and the rhythm of people's lives, which is what I think that this year without summer does, it messes with all of those patterns and rhythms that people are used to. That is so earth-shaking in a lot of ways because you come to count on all of those patterns that it does sort of psychologically change people and deserves some sort of label.
Yeah, I wonder if we'll name it after the like first obvious phenomenon of it. Like if a lot of people's jobs that were office jobs turn into work from home jobs, like maybe it's the work from home year, but a catchier title.
The year without brunch.
It also is like coinciding with summer. So maybe it's the year without like a fun summer, you know, like people want to be at the beach.
I feel like parents are going to win the day on this. So the year without camp, the year without school.
The year without camp, the year without school, the year of a glass of white wine at 4:45 p.m.
Yes. The year of day drinking.
Yeah, seriously, day drinking indoors.
And then one last story here, and this goes back a bit to, I think, when we were talking about pandemics and wars being reported as kind of happening at the same time. I feel like another famous same time event is the Great Depression and the Dust Bowl. Like, we know that the economy collapsed and also all of the Great Plains were just sort of blowing away. But there's also a little known thing where in the year 1936, there was one of the most massive heat waves in North American history. It was a situation where especially the Great Plains in the U.S. and Canada and also the Midwest were hit by a heat wave that killed 3,000 to 5,000 people in the U.S., hundreds more in Canada. Approximately $1 billion in modern dollars worth of produce was lost, and 15 states set all-time highs for temperatures, all of them above 110 degrees and a few of them above 120, because, you know, weather will do that. There will be a couple of years where it's just crazy. And this one, I don't know of like a volcanic eruption or something that caused it. It seems like this was just one of those years.
Yeah, I think it was just one of those years. But I think that one of the reasons this stands out is not only because 110 degrees is extremely hot, especially in an era where there's very little air conditioning. Trying to make it through that kind of heat is really difficult. But again, it's layered on top of a bunch of different catastrophes. You're in the middle of an economic depression. The Dust Bowl has ravaged several states in the middle of the country. And then you put on top of that this heat wave that's killing people. And you have to imagine that people at the time were just like, oh my God, when is this going to stop? And you're like, I'm here from the future. There's going to be a big world war. And then you get back on your feet. Yeah. It's just a really shocking time.
Wow. Yeah, if I could time travel, I would be like, wait for 1946. And they'd be like, what do you mean 46?
Yeah.
And then I'm all the way back at 36. I can't do that.
Yeah. But it is interesting, like when you think about these stretches, I mean, this is, you know, this is a summer. Like it's, I mean, obviously it's in the context of what you just described, Nikki, but it's like, I sometimes marvel at how much radical change can come out of a 3-month period, you know, mm-hmm. or a singular event, you know, and you look at all these ripple effects from just one incredibly hot summer. It's amazing. And it makes me think that, you know, we're 2 months into this crisis, but there's probably, I mean, we've been talking about it. There's probably already changes that are going to last for a century already put into motion. We may not be able to see them right now, but they're there and they happen really fast.
Yeah, that reordering of life in ways that you can't anticipate is the most interesting thing about it, right? Like, I feel like there are big things that we can point to that we expect to happen in the wake of tragedies and disasters, but it's the little ones, the unexpected ones, that I think are so fascinating. And in this case, like, the coincidence of the Dust Bowl, the Great Depression, and this heat wave, I mean, it helps to make one of the big aspects of the New Deal not just about saving the economy, but about saving the environment. And there's this huge part of the New Deal that's just about making the United States ecologically healthier. And that's pretty fascinating, too. People got that there was a real connection between, you know, a tree planted in Texas and the ability of the soil to hold in Oklahoma.
We'll have links about not only these temperatures, but also the Dust Bowl in general was brutal. And then in 1934, partly for that, and then it helped with this, too, the government started planting what's called the Great Plains Shelter Belt, which was a network of 100 million trees, 100 million stretching from Texas to Canada, mainly to hold soil and to try to like fix this just over-farmed chunk of the entire middle of the continent. And then farmers to this day are still trying to plant new trees to keep that going. And you don't think of the past as caring about the environment. I think of it as mostly littering and smokestacks.
Well, and you know, the joke that goes around now is nature healing itself now that all the humans have gone inside. But this really was a time yeah. when you could let the land lay fallow, where you could prevent that kind of over-farming that had been happening in the decades prior. And it really does allow the land to heal itself and is part of an environmental movement that had been going strong for probably 30 years by that time in the U.S.
With that environmental movement, those early successes were like starting to bring back the bison, right? And other things where they did like think about the environment more than we think they did and maybe more than we do sometimes.
Yeah. We had national parks. Teddy Roosevelt. It was great.
Well, yeah.
Oh, man.
Yeah, we started those. That was pretty good.
I can't wait to go back to a national park.
Wouldn't it be amazing?
Someday.
Because with this crisis in particular, we'll also have pictures of there were some times and even nights when people, because air conditioning was incredibly expensive. We'll have a Popular Mechanics article about how the first window cooling systems in the 1930s cost today's equivalent of six figures. Like, it was just not something people could do. The first air-conditioned car was in 1939. So as this 1936 heat wave hit, like people would just lay outside to try to get through some of the nights. There was one night in Lincoln, Nebraska in July of 1936 when they recorded a low of 91 degrees. Like imagine, like a low, the entire day is hotter than 91, even at night, even when you think it'll be fine. And it's just people like physically trying to get through what should be a great summer, you know, like go out and do stuff.
Yeah, it sounds deeply unpleasant. And you can understand why air conditioning starts to take off after this moment. Right? Yeah. There's, and actually, the New Deal has a lot to do with that, too, because, you know, a lot of rural places didn't have electricity during this period. And if you don't have electricity, you're not going to have air conditioning. Uh-huh. And so there's the Rural Electrification Administration is one of the big parts of the New Deal that brings electricity to these rural areas. And once they have that, and once they have more money, then you can start to have things like air conditioning.
If I remember right from your book, Nicole, one of the things conservative media tried to take out first was the Tennessee Valley Authority.
Oh, God, they hated
like,
they it so
like,
much.
Oh, the government having an energy company. No way. Forget it.
Yeah, they hated it so much. And there were all of these anti-TVA campaigns. This was a big part of rural electrification, was to set up this government authority that would deliver electricity to rural areas, because electric companies wouldn't do it. Like, it wasn't cost effective for them to run electricity out to places where there were so few customers. So if people in rural areas were going to get electricity, they were going to get it from the government. Same thing with things like the internet, right? Like, the government has to subsidize or own those lines in order to make them connected, because companies just won't do it because it's not profitable.
So, Nicole, when you say conservative media was against this, what do you mean by conservative media at that time?
So at this point, we're talking like in the 1950s and 60s, we're talking about magazines like National Review, newsletters, but also some radio programs as well. So the Mannion Forum was a big one in the 50s and 60s that was just like 15 minutes once a week. But to have somebody on air who was advocating for conservative government and rolling back the New Deal and getting rid of the Tennessee Valley Authority and also getting rid of Social Security and minimum wages was actually something pretty radical. So people having access to those programs helped to knit together a nationwide conservative movement that, again, like, just transforms, as we know, American politics.
Yeah, the idea of conservative media only occupying one 15-minute broadcast a week is remarkable.
It's kind of amazing. Yeah. Like, when I was writing about it, I was like, no, you have to understand. I'm talking about like 10 programs that are 15 minutes each, as opposed to this kind of wall-to-wall 3-hour program of Rush Limbaugh and then Sean Hannity and then Glenn Beck, plus cable news and all of these things. Like, it was just, it was important, and it has a tremendous effect on politics, but it is nothing like would come in the 1980s and 90s.
Linda, and as we kind of round things off, like, one reason I wanted to talk about all these crises and lockdowns and stuff is that I am glad we got through them. Like, obviously, many people are impacted. Obviously, many negative things happen. And also, there's still a country and stuff. But maybe I'm too optimistic. I don't know what you guys think of it.
Jody, will there be a country?
There will be a country. And I mean, you know, look, that's the thing I have been thinking about a lot. And I don't think I don't come down necessarily with a tidy answer. But I do think there is some value in just looking to the past and saying, all of that hardship, there's still a country here. And that happened, and now we're here. It was incredibly hard, and people died, and, you know, all those things. But also, like, there is, you know, I'm not ashamed to say that, like, I will cop to feeling some level of solace in just understanding that this country has been through really hard times before and will again. And
Yeah, I mean, historians used to write history. It was called the Whiggish School of History, where they would write about, like, America is always getting greater and we're always moving towards progress, and there are only brighter days ahead. And we've stopped doing that, which I think is a good thing, because I think that being able to look back and see, like, that there are periods where things are really, really awful. And just when you think things are going to turn the corner, bam, you get a heat wave. Bam, you get a world war. Bam, you get atomic weapons. Even through all of that, people find ways to fight for justice. They find ways to make their individual lives better. They find ways to try to make the country live up to its promise. Like, there are lots of hopeful stories embedded even in the worst moments in our country's history. And I think that there's something gratifying or inspiring to take out of that, especially when things look a little bleak.
I like taking something gratifying and inspiring.
Yeah, end it now.
Right, it's like, pull the cord, because that doesn't last long.
Roll the credits. This is this feeling won't last long.
Folks, that is the episode for this week. My thanks to Jody Avergan and Nicole Hemmer for making this episode happen, on top of taping many other episodes of things, all while locked down. You know, we are the Shakespeare, I'm starting to think, but also no one is. He was very special. Also, Shakespeare might have been a lady or a group of people. Who even knows? Anyway, enough Shakespeare conspiracy theories. In our footnotes, you will find all our sources for this locked down episode on lockdowns. In particular, three different episodes of the fantastic podcast entitled This Day in Esoteric Political History, hosted by Jody Avergan and Nicole Hemmer. That show was our source in particular for the 1942 East Coast dimouts, the Panic of 1893, and the probable situation where President Woodrow Wilson caught the famous 1918 flu pandemic. There are tons more great episodes of that show. I particularly recommend one about Koya Come Home. Just look for that in their feed. It's really good. You'll also find links to all things Jody and Nicole, and one of those things is the book Messengers of the Right by Nicole Hemmer. Again, that is just an amazing look at how things like the America First Committee created Fox News. No bigger conclusions to draw from that. You'll also find a link to the book Pax Americana, The Great Smallpox Epidemic of 1775 to 1782 by Elizabeth A. Fenn. And Dr. Fenn's book was very, very helpful to me making a Cracked project about how the American Revolution was just kind of a carnival of death. Like, there were all kinds of smallpox and prison ships and other things that we don't need to linger on in some kind of morbid way. It's just interesting to know that that was a much bloodier and more difficult war than I think it is otherwise presented as. Her book is fascinating, too. As we said, maybe we almost took Canada if not for germs. A whole thing going on. Highly recommend. And beyond all that, our theme music is Chicago Falcon by the Budos Band. This episode was engineered by me in Durham, North Carolina, and by Jody Avergan and Nicole Hemmer in different parts of Greater New York. Then it was edited by Chris Souza in Greater Los Angeles and broadcasted to you in Greater the Earth, probably. If you do listen on a space station, I need to know. I will be very excited. And if you love this episode, that's great. And drumroll, please. I am instituting a new feature in this bit of the outro. I'm going to read one review of the podcast, because if you give us a 5-star review on the platform of your choice, in particular Apple Podcasts, algorithms will tell people that the show exists, and a lot of people have already left very nice reviews, and I think that ought to be celebrated, so I'm going to start reading one review every week right here. Your name and words will be on the show. Also, I won't do all this setup next time. You'll just get the review. Apple user Blessed in Midwest says the following, quote, "I've been a fan of the podcast for many years now. Alex Schmidt's curiosity and interest in the subjects are contagious." Oh, thank you. "I always like episodes with Adam Todd Brown and Jason Pargin. Thank you and keep up the great work." End quote. And thank you so much, Blessed in Midwest. That really, really helps the show when you do things like that. You're great. And of course, counterfactual, let's say you hated this show. Well, then let me know about it on social media. That's right, social media. A place where Nicole Hemmer's Twitter account is at pastpunditry, which is a very fun handle. It kind of covers a lot of her research focus. And then Jody Avergan is at Jody Avergan. My own Twitter account is at Alex Schmitty. My Instagram is at Alex Schmitstagram. And I'm on the wider internet at my website, alexschmitty.com. And I'm here to say we will be back next week with more Cracked Podcast. So how about that? Talk to you then.